Welcome everybody to episode 68 of High Tech on the Low. Eddie, how are you this morning?
Great. Awesome to see you.
Awesome to see you. Finally having you in the studio. It's exciting. I know we talked a few months ago, and now we're here. We have Eddie Benami from Neuralite, co-founder and CEO?
CTO.
CTO, excuse me, of Neuralite.ai, and we're going to get into that in a little bit. But first, we're always sponsored by Front Team Communities with 12 different communities, 6 verticals, and 3,000 entrepreneurs and investors and tech enthusiasts all looking to connect with you. And we are going to talk a little bit about interesting types of connections, synapses, neurology, all this fun buzzwords of the day. But first, Eddie, introduce yourself to the people at home. Who are you? And what is Neuralite?
So I'm Eddie. I'm a mathematician. Neuralite is my life for a year and a half now.
Year and a half now.
Yep. Yeah. Okay. Time flies by when you're having fun.
Right. As they say.
So we are going to change neurology. We're the plan is to take a huge area of medicine, which is neurology and psychiatry, that is really, in a way, the same as it was 150 years ago. It's still based on physicians looking at patients and using their intuition to figure out what's wrong and what's working and what's not.
Right.
And bring some quantifiable measurements into that.
Interesting. That's ambitious.
Yeah.
It's saying we're going to change neurology. That's ambitious.
Yeah, that's what we're going to do.
Wow.
So, you know.
And you say that so calmly, too. You're just like, yep, it's happening.
You know, one step at a time. Every right. long, how do they say about Jews? We're we're not afraid of many, taking long roads with many steps.
Okay. Yeah. Well, alas. So where did this idea come from? You know, because, I mean, it sounds like, you know, really to come with, I mean, that's very, I mean, truly, it's ambitious.
That's
what you're saying.
That's really sweet of you.
Yeah. to come and want to change, like, you know, an entire field of medicine, entire field of, I mean, not even exactly, you know, medicine, but psychology too. I mean, there's a lot of different things here. Where did it come from?
So it actually was a little bit, by chance. We were, okay. A while ago, about 2-3 years ago, I started playing with looking into data that can be extracted from EEG signals.
Okay.
Just because, you know, it was COVID and I had nothing better to do. So
why not?
Yeah.
So why not? Okay. Wait, EEG being?
So it's the measurement of electricity using electrodes that are stuck to your your head. It's
okay, so that was for everyone at home who may not know neurology as deep as you.
Electroencephalography.
Okay.
So, when I was looking at it, I found myself using video of the face as some additional measurement, and I got really good at measuring things related to facial movements.
Okay.
And then I just started reading some articles because I wanted to figure out how all these things that I'm looking into can be actually useful.
So you're like trying to understand how you can connect between the EEG signal, the way your face is looking,
things
and
like
other
that.
Things.
I wasn't really sure what I was.
You were just looking around.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
You're like kind of like the what would it be, the eternal searcher, right? You know, like going for it. Just like, what is this? What is this? What is this?
That was like a nerd that was trying to have some fun.
I tried to make it so much nicer for
you.
Yeah,
thank you. Thank you. That's how nerds are having
okay,
fun.
Okay, fair enough. Okay, so you're looking this up, you're researching.
And I stumbled upon this article that was talking about relations between eye movements and Parkinson's. And
okay.
Then I realized that there are a lot of those. Like, slowly I found out that it's like hundreds of articles.
Like, specifically on Parkinson's and eye movement.
Yes.
Wow.
And so I asked a friend, and she told me, oh, you have to go talk to this amazing professor at Beilinson.
Okay.
And I went to talk to her.
Okay.
And then slowly I started figuring out that, first of all, there is a lot of research around eye movements and, in general, neurological and later psychiatric disorders.
But specifically using eye movements
yes.
to kind of like infer what may happen?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
And apparently it's like a thing. It's something that started... So the research really started more than 100 years ago.
Okay.
Germans used to do a lot of research in psychiatric hospitals.
Okay.
They would like glue little mirrors to the eyeballs of psychiatric patients.
Oh, that's
and,
lovely.
And, don't worry, the glue comes off after a few weeks.
Okay, right. A
yeah.
little clockwork orangey, but
yes.
alas, you know.
most of the The large jump started in the 50s with Kahneman's work. Tversky and Kahneman started looking at eye movements as a measure for cognition.
Okay.
So Kahneman had this thing. He's this super awesome person. He's also a part-time doing psychology, but he was like, he's interested in many things. He's okay. A scholar.
Renaissance man.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And it really bothered him that there are no quantitative measures in psychology. So he was one of the first people that brought in questionnaires, because that was a huge jump from just having open discussions.
Sure.
And then he was looking into something even more quantitative. And, you know, he probably heard somewhere that eyes are the window to the soul. And they started doing measurements. And they had this number of amazing articles that was showing that with the use of that, like they could infer the amount of cognitive effort and use of memory while giving people simple tasks by measuring their pupils.
And so you find this
so
research.
What did this do for you?
I mean, it sounds like it's very, I mean, this is basically what you're trying to do.
Yeah, yeah. And then it seems like ever since that time, people were doing that more and more.
Okay.
And of course, in the last 20, 30 years, where people started getting into measuring and learning things, you know, with all the machine learning vibe that took over the world.
Sure.
So,
of course. Yeah. Plus the whole digital health revolution.
Yeah,
and everything.
Exactly.
Okay.
So people started looking into, you know, external and non-invasive measures that might be interesting. And all of a sudden, in the last 30 years, a huge amount of psychiatrists and neurologists and everything in between, like neuroscientists, were doing all these experiments showing that on one hand, there is a really strong relation between eye movements and a huge span of interesting things in neurology and psychiatry.
Okay.
And on the other hand, there was a lot of work in that was spent on understanding the process. So it's not a black box. Like, there are people that are actually made huge advancements into understanding why these things are happening. So
like,
it's
basically understanding the interconnection between the eye and, let's say, whatever
neurological disorder
is coming up.
Exactly.
Wow. Okay, so making the real definitive connection.
Yeah, so
wow.
Like, in the way scientists like, it's not like a machine learning thing in the sense that we're measuring a lot of stuff, you know, things are connected, it's going to be okay.
Okay.
It's more of the vibe of, okay, we understand what's happening there and why it's connected.
Okay, wow. So you're looking at this, you're sitting there trying to make sense of all this research that you've been doing in Corona while you're at home, quarantine's going on, everything's crazy. What's next?
So I started looking for someone to work with, and my best friend said, oh, you know, there is this really cool guy, he's like an awesome person in general, really smart, he's interested in science. He's probably going to be interested in being an angel for your startup. Go talk to him.
Well, like, why not? What do you have to lose?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. And then I met the guy, and it was like a love story. It's Micha is my partner, my amazing partner. We have been like inseparable since. You know, inseparable as much as you can be with someone who lives in Austin.
Okay. Well, that's cool. An international founding team. That's not always that usual.
So he was a Tel Avivian then.
Okay.
But
now he's moved to Austin subsequently.
Yeah, because Tel Aviv is not cool enough for him, and Austin is weird, right? That's what they say.
Well,
they
it's weird. Keep Austin weird.
Yeah.
I know that. Okay. For sure.
So, and we really hit it off, and he was like super excited, and we started talking about, you know, okay, so we have something that we understand is amazing, but amazing in the scientific sense. And now there was the part of understanding what's the best way to make everyone use it. So
and how to make a business out of
it. Yeah, yeah. Okay. Because it's like one of these situations where, okay, we know where we are now. We know we have like this general understanding.
Sure.
We know where we want to be 15 years from now,
right.
Which is, that's what everyone uses. Like,
right, 15, you want to transform neurology.
Yeah.
Okay. In
15 years from now, we want people just to be able to passively get a neurological or a psychiatric examination while they're playing with their smartphone.
Exactly. Okay.
And we want that to be, that's going to be like, instead of going to do like all these complicated examinations, it's going to give so much more information to everyone. It's not an easier way to do what's being done today. It's a way, way, way better and more accurate way to do what's being done today. And on the way, it's easier, more comfortable. You can do that at home, which is amazing because usually many of those diseases are coming with older age, so
of course
it's always nicer when you can
it streamlines the whole process, it sounds like. But basically you're trying to set a new standard of how we can diagnose neurological disorder.
So both diagnose and assess progression, which means that it's going to be easier to decide which treatment and to give a person, and whether you need to change it or change dosage, or even before that, to help develop drugs. Because all these problems that you're talking about in the treatment of patients, it's already a problem that's happening during the drug development process. Because there are problems with...
So it's kind of like the chicken or the egg type of situation. Yeah. It's like, so, we can't get the right drugs to help them, so they're not getting helped and everything. Okay, so...
Like, just to give a general idea, so about 30% of Parkinson's patients don't have Parkinson's.
Okay, really?
Yeah.
Wait, you're saying that 30% of people who are diagnosed, we can put that in quotations,
yes,
as having Parkinson's, don't actually have it?
Yeah, it's actually worse in the beginning. Like the first year of Parkinson's patients, if someone is a Parkinson's patient and has been diagnosed for less than a year and is showing some reaction to drugs, there is a 70% chance they don't have Parkinson's, and that decreases to a 30% chance after 3 to 5 years.
Is this research you guys...
No, that's like a known thing.
There's a known thing?
Yeah, it's a known thing.
And the medical community is just okay with that?
Because they, you know, it's... It doesn't help not to be okay with something if you don't have a better solution.
Sure, but I mean, you're telling me that 1 in 3 people, basically, almost, if they're diagnosed with Parkinson's, don't actually have it.
Yeah, and the numbers are like similar with other diseases as well, with Alzheimer's and with multiple sclerosis. So they're lower. They can be like about, on average, for neurological patients, we're talking about 20-25% of misdiagnosis. And I don't even want to start talking about the psychiatric patients, where it's like a really known thing that no one knows what's going on.
Okay.
So, and on the other hand, the process of figuring out how bad is someone's situation, just to give another example. So what is being used today is questionnaires. So a physician has this checkbox, a list of checkboxes.
Right.
And they need to score each of these checkboxes.
But it's very subjective.
Yeah. So they need to decide between 0 to 4, how good is someone's walking.
Right. How anxious he is.
Yeah, whatever. Sure. And one of the... a big thing that is interesting when people are measured for ALS. So one of the questions that are actually being asked is, people need to say between 0 to 4 how difficult it is for them to button their shirt. That's like a part of the measure of how much ALS you have. Now, it's both a problem when the physician needs to decide what to do with the patient and what's their situation, but that's how they decide whether a drug is effective or not. Mm. Not to mention that, of course, when that's the general way you do things, there is no way to distinguish between different kinds of patients.
Sure. Also, it's a very weird way to talk about shirts. Not all shirts are made the same.
Yeah,
not
exactly.
All buttons are made the same.
What if you have zippers?
Right? Oh, there we go. So you guys at Neurolite then, when you came up with this whole kind of, you know, I mean, revolution of trying to use, I guess, more data-centered models here to kind of assess what neurological or psychological disorder someone has, treatment, is it working, whatever. You guys basically made a whole change just in the whole way people are looking at neurology. But now, how is your solution actually making it easier for me to get diagnosed and assessed with my treatment and assessed for this whole drug development?
So we still did not make a change in everyone's thought. Right now, it's only the thought of the people that are working in Neurolite, because everyone that or you know, helping us. But
okay.
But in general, you know, every revolution starts
someplace.
Small.
Yeah, we can say.
But the bottom line is that when there is so much noise, then everything is like more or less. And the idea is that the moment you can measure things in a more stable way, in a more accurate way, in a way that you can actually detect smaller changes, which means that you can detect them in shorter periods of time.
Sure.
Which means that you need smaller experiments to figure out whether something is working, because, you know, you have less noise, you don't need as large experiments. And when everything is more accurate, then you can actually discern between different kinds of patients. So, sure. So the idea is that we want to set a really new standard for both diagnosis and measuring the severity of a disease, and help from the phase of drug development through the phase of actually diagnosing patients and figuring out what's the best treatment to give them.
Okay.
Right now, we are focusing on the drug development phase because we're trying to... That's our first small step.
Is it an easier market to enter?
So it's mainly easier situation.
Okay.
It's an easier situation for two reasons. One, when you want to get to a lot of patients, then you actually need to, you know, convince a lot of physicians.
Sure.
And when you touch patients in a standard situation, you need to do that only once you're already very well validated, you have FDA approvals. It's a really, really long process. People need to feel extremely comfortable with doing that for you to be part of something standard.
Okay.
In drug development, the whole situation is non-standard, and it's...
so it's easier to kind of access in that sense.
Yeah, and okay. It's really, really well monitored.
Right,
so okay. Everyone feels much more comfortable with trying new things because everything is new, and everyone is trying to help. You know, drug companies are very often being thought of as like these huge
monsters.
Awful creatures.
We can call it, yeah.
Yeah.
Call it for what it is.
But in reality, when you think about this, it's companies that have a very narrow margin. Like usually, it's a huge bet to be a drug company, even if you're a huge one.
Right.
And they're just, you know, trying to find drugs that are going to help patients.
And you know, so you're trying to come in that kind of mandate and say, hey, we want to monitor these guys.
Yeah,
we'll give you data, and the data will help you make better drugs.
Exactly.
Okay.
So
sounds like a good plan in that sense.
And it's such a good plan that we're not the first ones that are trying that plan.
Okay.
So many companies that were trying to use a more data-driven approach to medicine actually started with pharma companies. One of these companies is Flatiron Health,
okay.
Which is their former CTO is my co-founder and mentor.
Wow!
And he was like my first commander in the military.
Okay.
So we're like friends for 25 years. He's the most awesome person in history, and he taught me everything I know.
Okay.
But many other companies have used this approach of like Foundation Medicine and others.
And what sets you apart, though, from your competitors?
So the two companies I mentioned now are doing oncology.
Okay.
In general, oncology is a field that is already slowly transforming this way. So you can both see this process of... No one is talking about cancer in general anymore.
Okay.
Everyone is talking about specific cancers and super specific cancers inside the specific cancers, right? No one is talking about...
Right, it's not just
solving
a general
cancer.
Thing. Right.
They're not even talking about solving lung cancer anymore. They're talking about solving each of the specific kinds of cancer.
Okay.
And this is very helpful because,
right.
Of course, it's easier to solve a more specific problem.
Sure.
And
but you're saying that no one's really doing it for neurology. They haven't really been able to do that whole differentiation model yet.
Yes, everyone who has... So, as we said before, not even everyone who has Parkinson's actually has Parkinson's. But even amongst those patients, it's like Parkinson's patients. So if you want a drug that to be approved, it needs to be good for Parkinson's, like for every Parkinson's patient.
Interesting.
So it's a little bit like saying if you want a cancer drug to be approved, it needs to be effective for
all
like,
cancer
patients.
Right, but that doesn't... Well, what does that mean?
Yeah.
Right, okay.
So that's part of the reason it's so difficult to find drugs for these diseases because they're so... You know, these are very general diseases that are not very well understood. There is a lot of unknowns in there. And it's in many of those diseases, it's not even... There are actual thoughts that it's not even one disease. So
gotcha.
ALS, for instance... is a not completely well-defined disease, and there are theories about a spectrum of diseases around ALS. It's called the ALS frontotemporal dementia spectrum.
Okay.
And in general, this is another thing that we want to help with. So
kind of linking these disparate elements together and trying to understand how to then better make drugs
yeah.
to solve the problem.
Yeah.
So right now, how are you monitoring these guys? They're at home. They're not at home. They're at health centers.
So because we're doing small steps, so it's true that in the future we want to monitor people with their phone at home while they just, you know, scroll through Instagram.
Yeah, sure. Okay.
And, which is surely going to be what 80-year-olds are going to do in the future.
Okay.
But
awesome. I have something to look forward to. Okay.
because, you know, even 80-year-olds won't use Facebook in the future.
Right, but, of course. I mean, listen, we're going to use TikTok. Come on. Chinese will have all our information. It'll be good.
So right now we are trying to bring as much value as possible as quickly as possible. So we're working with pharma companies the way they work. So right now, patients are coming to a clinical center for a drug trial, right? So they're coming over. The physician is giving them a checkup,
right,
to discern what's their state. They're getting the drug or whatever. And the monitoring is happening in the clinical center. So what we're doing is when they're coming to the clinical center, we have like our we have a laptop there, and they're just sitting in front of that laptop for 10 minutes. Either before or after their checkup with the physician.
And do they have to like do a little program?
No, they need to sit in front of the laptop, and they're asked to follow a dot that's moving on the screen, and that's it.
Wow.
They do that for 10 minutes.
And that's it?
Yeah,
That would drive me nuts.
So you'd be surprised.
I would then get diagnosed after that, I think.
Yeah, so you'd be surprised, but we're collecting a lot of information on both healthy subjects and actually in clinical trials, both in a clinical, we're part of a clinical trial for an ALS drug with a company called Neurosense.
Okay.
And we're also running a Parkinson's and soon a multiple sclerosis trial in Mount Sinai.
Congrats.
And thank you. And one of the things that we see is that when we collect data from young, like really young, like Gen Z people,
okay,
they really are saying things that are similar to you, like, oh my god, this was awful, I had to like
sit. Why did I have to sit
yeah,
there?
I had
you're
to
driving
sit
me nuts.
And look at the dog for 10 minutes, this is awful. And when it's like older people or especially like actual patients, they're like, wow, this was amazing, I'm used to like having my my spine punctured with a needle, so like this is incredible. Just give me more of
so
that.
Anything, you know, I guess when you have kind of that level to look at, yeah, it makes a lot of sense, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So and they are just like watching this dot, and from that you can assess the eye movements that you guys were that you, like it's kind of the basis of this.
Yeah. So what happens is that we're collecting some specific markers of reactions to these visual stimuli, the dot that's moving on the screen. And then we are using known research to translate that into something that has clinical meaning.
Okay.
And then, you know, on top of that, there is some really small machine learning part that we're using to translate all of those to the actual clinical scale that is used today.
Okay.
So if today they have these clinical scales that physicians are half guessing to give,
right, 0 to 5.
Yeah,
okay.
We can give them this 0 to 5, but our 0 to 5 is on one hand correlated with what the physician will do. This is, by the way, what we're doing now in the clinical trials is validating that we're really as good as what the physician would do,
or even better, because theoretically you're more precise and actually hitting on data points.
Exactly.
Okay.
So, but on one hand, we need to show that we are strongly correlated with what physicians would do, because that's what everyone does right now.
Okay.
On top of that, we want to show that our measurements are so stable and sensitive that if, for instance, in a multiple sclerosis trial, depending on the specifics, but you need between a year and 2 years to actually see statistically significant change in patients, we can see statistically significant change in patients in 2 to 3 months.
Wow.
So, and that's going to be, by the way, the difference between when this is going to become the new standard. It's going to be the difference between a process that takes years today.
You could save
development
lives.
Process, yeah.
You could save lives much faster. I mean, you could actually tell someone that they maybe are even, you know, kind of pre-Alzheimer's way in advance. Or
just take a drug that wouldn't have been approved because it's not effective for all the MS or Alzheimer's patients, but only for a subpopulation.
Right. And or like say, ALS, as you were saying, which has all these subpopulations. Okay.
And say, okay, but it's true. It's not helping everyone, but it does help these people.
These guys, right. It helps these 5 million people who have it and not all 50 million or something like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Oh, wow. So how, you know, I have so many questions, obviously, here about this, because it's very interesting. You know, we have on the show, I've you know, interviewed people who also are working in the neuroscience space before, and they come at it a little differently than you. It's a little bit more of a decentralized neuroscience diagnosis, but you're much more kind of saying, I'm here to try to make the whole diagnosis and help more clear, you know, which I find very unique. How are you able to convey this kind of vision to, you know, your partners, investors, or the drug companies that you're working with, and how did they take it?
So let's start from the people that join Neuralite and the people that are working with us. So in general, if you talk to a neurologist, everyone is going to agree that the situation is awful.
Okay.
If you talk to...
So you have your market.
Yeah. If you talk to a scientist in a drug company, they're going to say the situation is awful.
Okay.
No one is... there is, of course, the thing that because in medicine, the whole process is much more regulated and everyone is, for very good reasons, conservative, then everything is like very data-driven and everyone wants to be sure that things are, you know, really working and no one wants to do anything hasty. And everything needs to be like very, very, very validated.
Right.
Before,
I mean, they need to have the credentials. But yes. And you come off really well at that because you're saying, listen, I got data. I want to use data and I want to make it better for you.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. But still, how do you get them to buy into the vision?
So, first of all, one of the first conversations we had, Micha and I, was with the person that now is our chief innovation officer. She is the most incredible person in the universe. Her name is Dr. Rivka Kreitman. She was the head of R&D in Teva until 3 years ago.
Okay.
And then she retired and she was like consulting for different companies.
Okay.
And we started talking and she was like, oh my God, this is what I've been looking for.
Like, this is the next step. Okay.
Yeah. And then she actually came back from retirement because she said, I want to make this happen. And in general, we have amazing reactions from the most prominent people in the field. So we're working with...
So you have like industry Professor validation, Tom, basically.
Yeah, so Professor Tom Sudhoff was like, he's this amazing neuroscientist. He got his... he was the one of the pioneers of synaptic... transmission,
and he's on your board.
He got a Nobel Prize for that.
He's, okay,
he's on our advisory board. He's working with us. He's we're working with Professor Fred Lublin, who is the most prominent multiple sclerosis expert that is working today. And
how did you get to these people?
So some of them talk to us because they know how awesome Rivka is, so they just... They were like, oh,
if Rivka's in it, we're in it.
Yeah.
Okay.
And some of us, some of them, so Tom is a friend of a friend. I know a lot of old people.
Okay.
old soul. but in general, all these people are, you know, it's true that the conversation started from really positive places, but they really felt like on one hand, it's... there is innovation here, but not too much. That's more or less like the thing that made everyone really happy.
It's kind of also, it's just like kind of making processes better in a sense.
Yeah, because on one hand, it's clear that we're improving things, not by like a small amount, but there is a large improvement. On the other hand, it's not like something like, oh, you know, there is going to be some black magic and it's going to be okay.
Right.
It's a process that they understand. There are no black boxes there. It's something that has been talked about for many, many years, and somehow it felt like the main thing that was missing was just to take all of this existing science and for some good engineers to come and turn this into something that's actually useful. Instead of people who are saying something like, you know, these situations that people are looking at something saying, oh, this is such a good idea. Someone should do something about that. So that's kind of us. Like we did not need to you know, convince people that there is this thing that no one ever thought about. It's something that's been
it's
around
like
a for a while.
Logical step almost. Yeah, they're just like, oh yeah, you mean that this guy 100 years ago, like they saw this and we haven't done it then. It's just been like waiting in his desk drawer for 100 years.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And because we on one hand are making this actually happen, but in a way that's actually easy to use and smooth and it's not causing friction, then the price of trying is very low.
Right.
And then when it's clear that you can get a lot of, you know, when you can gain a lot from trying and you don't need to work too hard or suffer too much, then people are much more open to it.
This is honestly a perfect segue into our last question of the podcast, which is, what then is your advice for other entrepreneurs, knowing that you've kind of come about your own venture like this, where you're kind of, you know, we sit here sometimes, you know, I'll sit with entrepreneurs here and it'll be, you know, you'll have very innovative thoughts. You'll have people innovating on processes. You'll have people who kind of just came at an idea from, you know, experience or seeing things not work. But you seem to have molded multiple facets of that journey. You have both kind of, you know, being just, you know, as you put it, a nerd who just found stuff out, seeing kind of lost information that hasn't been put together in a sense and applied in the right way. And then you've like also been able to try to innovate that using innovative, you know, technology, basically. What's your advice then for entrepreneurs out there in a similar position?
So I have two things that I try to keep in mind all the time. One is a really classic advice, because that was, I feel that was the biggest mistake I've done in my previous company. And that is, you know, we were building a product, but the process was that until we have this huge leap, we have nothing. So one of the things that was most important for us was to have a process in which, you know, we want to get really, really far. We want to change neurology, right. But we made sure it's like really a long series of very small steps. That was like one thing that was really important for us. And the other thing was that each of these small steps need to, you know, you want to do like a really huge innovation in the end, but you need to make sure that it's like not too much innovation in each of these tiny steps, because it makes it both easier to actually make it happen and easier for people to swallow, because people usually don't, even when people agree with you, it's difficult for people to try something new. So it needs to be new, but not new enough for them to be interested, but not too new for them to be scared.
I love that line. Interested enough. Wait, what? Say it one more time.
New enough to be interesting, but not too new for them to be scared.
That's awesome. That's a great line. That should be a T-shirt. I'm telling you, if that's not the slogan of Neuralite, like tomorrow, you did it wrong. No, but I'm joking. Either way, Eddie, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
Really amazing. I think you guys are doing some really cool work there. It was cool to just hear the journey and everything. As always, you can listen to more episodes like this on Spotify or Apple Music. We're there. We have all the episodes. And thank you so much for coming on, Eddie.
Oh, it's so fun talking to you. I hope next time we have beer together.
Amazing. Yeah. Amazing.